This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Hey, are you still hanging in there? What a week it has been. Between the State of the Union address, the impeachment vote, the governor's budget plan, and so much more, you could be forgiven for missing a few pretty big stories this week. So with us for a somewhat sporting news roundup are John Neo, Detroit News sports columnist, and Bill Shea, who reports on sports business for The Athletic. Gentlemen, welcome.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, same.
So the shoe dropped this week. Michigan State University's beloved football coach Mark D'Antonio announced his retirement. Not a huge surprise, but can you remind us what makes the timing of this so interesting? John, you want to start?
It's February, and the coaching carousel has largely halted in college football, and now it's spinning again, at least in East Lansing, which is, I think that back in November, Mark D'Antonio, there have been lots of questions. You mentioned it's not a complete shock. There's been speculation that he was nearing the end and was asked about it in November when coaches start to really think about these sort of things. And he said, no, he planned to stick around for another season at least. December came, a bowl game came and went, the end of the season. And it had been radio silence until just this week. And that's, I think, the timing was the shock for everybody, including coaches on his own staff, players in his locker room, and administrators.
It was so close to signing day.
Yeah, it was the day before National Signing Day. So the timing, I think, struck everybody as not just awkward, but strange. And that just set forth what is probably going to be a strange process now as they look for a new coach.
Right. With D'Antonio's recruiting director, Curtis Blackwell, continuing an ongoing lawsuit, he says that D'Antonio and the program committed NCAA violations. Bill, how close do you think the Hounds are to D'Antonio's heels?
And, I think we're going to see in the next few months how this is going to play out. By staying as long as he did, he got, I think it was a $4.3 million bonus. So I guess from a personal financial standpoint, I understand that. I really think as the court cases and such play out, we'll have a better sense, I think, in the first half of this year. But definitely we will get a sense of what's going to happen. And it really does, my personal take on this is there's going to be another shoe that drops with this whole thing. I'm not sure what that might be. With the lawsuit. And, Michigan State Athletics for several years now has been in a very uncomfortable national spotlight. So I'm really not surprised, unfortunately, by anything anymore out of East Lansing.
Well, some would say if you don't have NCAA violations in your program, you may not actually have an NCAA program. John, what's your take on that? How serious are the charges that Blackwell brought up by comparison to some other things we've seen?
Well, they're still a bit vague and threatening, but not entirely played out, I guess, if you would call it that. I think a lot of folks are left sort of scratching their heads, though, wondering why Michigan State hasn't settled that case. It's been, sort of a steady drip of bad publicity, some fairly damning accusations that, the recruit from 2016 who was later found guilty of sexual assault and is in jail now was a guy that Mark D'Antonio almost single-handedly, it seems, brought in, insisted on bringing in. But then there's, as Bill mentioned, there does feel like there could be more to this. And it's a case that Curtis Blackwell has now brought in a lawyer, Tom Mars, who's a well-known attorney who's been involved in lots of other cases, including, among other things, essentially bringing down Ole Miss's football program with NCAA violations and a coach fired. So I think there are certainly signs that there's more to this and how much of it comes out. I mean, this is a case that's proceeding towards possible trial, but right now is more lawyers arguing back and forth at this point.
John, Bill, you're both Detroit guys. This week, the city of Detroit took some landlords to court, a trio of real estate investors who the city says stand among the most notorious, their word, slumlords. It looks like a lot of the properties in question were in foreclosure and bought at auction. There's nothing illegal about that, of course. But the city says the issue is that these owners have been buying properties, renting them in just dreadful conditions since they don't have the money to fix them up right away. I wanted to ask, Bill, maybe how have you seen foreclosure and speculation change the city?
Well, there's obviously the national comeback narrative for Detroit. We all know what Detroit's reality and reputation was for so many decades, and then improvement began. And I think because there was interest in people looking at, hey, you know, there's opportunities now in Detroit, you know, the infamous, you know, hey, come buy a house for a dollar, that sort of thing. When you get that sort of speculation and in interest, it brings a lot of unsavory characters often, you know, to the situation. And I think Detroit is fairly unique in the United States in having just absolutely astounding numbers of properties available. And you know, it's easy to, you know, cheap cash. It was easy to gobble up these properties. It's expensive to maintain them. Going back to that infamous, you know, hey, buy a house for a buck in Detroit. Well, you may be able to buy a house for a buck, but it may need $250,000 worth of fixes to bring it up to, you know, just the very most basic living standards, you know, to protect it from weather and bring it up to code. That's an expensive proposition, and people discover that, hey, I don't have the financial capability to do this. And some people just don't care. I can't speak on behalf of this trio, but, you know, I think it's an important issue that Detroit has to take care of, because part of the ongoing narrative with this city, is cleaning up the blight, the slums that have been allowed to happen for a variety of reasons. You know, there's been progress over the years. You know, I lived downtown for a long time, and I see the vast acres of what are now basically urban prairies, mm-hmm. where the housing has been torn down, and a lot more of that needs to happen. Or people need to fix up what they own. That's just, you know, it's good for everyone when that happens.
So why hasn't the city gone after the Illiches? Aren't they slumlords of a different kind?
Well, go ahead, John.
No, I was just about to say the same thing. I mean, I'm sure there are a lot of residents in the city that would say, well, that's fine. There's certainly these three guys who have whatever it is, 1,000 properties to their names. That's a problem. But so is the fact that you have a billionaire who has really run roughshod over city ordinances and everything else. I mean, certainly the Illich operation has been ticketed many, many times for sitting on properties that have been vacant for years and years and speculating themselves. So I think there is a disconnect there in terms of what's illegal and what's hailed as development.
Yeah, and this is a case of, you know, small potatoes guys who might have 1,000 properties. Right. The Illich family is enormously powerful. They're political donors. I mean, they're billionaires, and they have built up a lot of goodwill with a certain segment of the population because of the success. The success that's now more distant in the past of their hockey and baseball teams. You know, the pizza company obviously has been extremely successful. And it's politically a little harder to go after folks like that. They're not universally demonized. It's a lot easier to go after a Matty Maroon, who really doesn't have any mm-hmm. cheerleaders in the community.
Right.
And his well-deserved reputation as a slumlord on both sides of the Detroit River. And the Illiches, you know, their speculation was to build mostly the District Detroit, and that really hasn't happened like they promised. So, and they're a bit more in the crosshairs than they've been in the past. So I'm really curious to see how things will play out with them.
Do you think that's because of people talking about them more and just sort of identifying them as being part of the problem?
I think absolutely. You know, before I left Cranes, we did a big piece, I think it was last March, looking at the absolute lack of progress on the district. I mean, they did build a great arena. Mm-hmm. They got a lot of tax dollars to help out with that. But, you know, we showed people, hey, here's what they promised in 2012. These gleaming, gorgeous drawings of a bustling downtown. And here today, here's the pictures of the parking lots. And there's some really nice parking lots, but that's not what they promised to build for everybody. Parking lots make money, but the stuff that they promised to build also makes money, you know, apartments and bars and restaurants. And they said they would do it, and they did not. And I think there's been increasing public pressure because of the journalism that a lot of people have done over the last several years and hopefully will continue to do.
Parking lots also don't drink lead-tainted water. They don't have tenants to do those things. And I think that's, I guess, not to make light of this, but that's the other difference, is that they've just got a lot of vacant properties.
Yeah. Well, before we go, Kansas City just celebrated its first Super Bowl win. I mean, the Lions ever be there, too? Yeah,
you had to go there, didn't you?
I did.
No, the drumbeat's getting louder, right? I mean, the Cubs won a World Series. Cleveland, Bill's beloved Cleveland, won an NBA title a few years ago. Washington celebrated both an NHL and a Major League Baseball title.
I mean,
so it's Detroit's turn.
Who's left in the NFL who hasn't been there?
I can tell you the Detroit Lions, the Cleveland Browns, the Jacksonville Jaguars, and the Houston Texans. Two of those teams are, you know, in the last 20 years.
Expansion teams came in. Right, yeah.
I call it the Book of Revelations Apocalypse Bowl, the Browns and the Lions meeting for the first time in the Super Bowl.
Right.
And there's no winner. They just keep playing forever and ever and ever. Then the world dies of when the sun explodes.
That is absolutely how I felt with the Indians and the Cubs a couple of years
ago.
I had to go there too, right? Yeah.
I was former Clevelander right there with you, Bill. I was dying. Well, Bill Shea, sports business reporter for The Athletic, and John Neo, sports columnist for the Detroit News. Guys, next year in Jerusalem.
There we go. Sounds good.
Great.